Today, the existential crises, the DFA Daily to the 13th of April 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Existential means simply a threat to existence. And I've noted that the term is being thrown about in the media at the moment. So today we look at whether we can possibly engineer an existential crisis for the virus, meaning stamping it out. And second, whether the virus could create an existential crisis for the Eurozone. In both cases, the answer could well be yes. The Grattan Institute blog makes the point that New Zealand is beating the coronavirus. They are the envy of the world with a realistic chance of eliminating it from the country within the next couple of months. This goes against the mainstream, dare I say, business-centric view that we have to unlock the economy and quick, despite a rise in deaths. Stephen Duckett, the Grattan Institute's health program director, wrote that a week ago it seemed impossible that Australia could join the Kiwis, but a growing body of evidence shows that if we can hold the course for a little longer, we can beat the virus too. He says Australia is not far behind New Zealand in cases, and we are catching up. We're currently recording about 100 cases a day, which is only slightly more than New Zealand's peak of 87 a week ago. Most individual states in Australia are already ahead of New Zealand, and if they stay the course and keep stage 3 restrictions going, they could beat New Zealand to zero. Growing epidemiological evidence points to the possibility of elimination. Recent modelling by the University of Sydney found that with spatial distancing, the virus could be all but gone from Australia by the second week of June, and improved contact tracing could probably prevent a resurgence of the disease. Separate modelling published on Friday by researchers at the University of Melbourne reached the same conclusion, and New Zealand modelling previewed by Jacinta Ardern on Friday suggests that the country has a better than even chance of being virus-free by late June, just 2 months away. In contrast, modelling released by the Doe Institute for the Australian Government did not even consider scenarios with the degree of spatial distancing we are achieving in Australia today, and therefore it does not help us understand if elimination is possible in Australia and by when. The prospect of 90 days of stage 3 restrictions, of course, is daunting, but there are good reasons to believe we could bring cases down to zero earlier than that. The University of Sydney and the University of Melbourne models simulate enough spatial distancing to halve the number of cases roughly every 16 days, but for the past week, Australian cases have been halving every 4.2 days. Even if that trend slows over the next few weeks, there's a real prospect that many states could begin easing spatial distancing as early as May, with a clear plan in place by Anzac Day. Getting from nearly zero cases to zero cases is, of course, the toughest part of the elimination strategy. We will need to trace down every single case, isolating and testing all the people they may have come into contact with. And some towns or suburbs might need to stay on stage 3 restrictions for longer to stamp out the last remaining cases, and some schools might have to be closed again if cases flared up. We would need to quarantine international arrivals until a vaccine is found. And I might add, if hotspots do break out, then they must be stamped on, such as now is happening in Tasmania's Northwest Regional Hospital and Northwest Private Hospital in Burnie, which has been closed today because of an outbreak. As reported by the ABC, all staff and members of their households, more than 1,000 people, will go into quarantine for 2 weeks. The hospitals will shut from 7 a.m. on Monday for a deep clean. And patients from the Northwest Regional Hospital will be sent to the Mersey Community Hospital, but a limited few patients will be sent to other hospitals in the state that can provide the care they need. Patients that will be transferred include those in the Spencer Clinic, medical and surgical wards. Of the 144 cases in Tasmania, 72 are linked to the northwest coast, and 43 are healthcare workers at the hospitals. So far, 5 people have died in the state. And the Grattan Institute concludes that a successful elimination strategy would give most Australians a good chance of resuming a near-normal life well before the end of the year. And if we succeed, crowds could return to the MCG in time for the Boxing Day test. Now that is a goal we should embrace. Meantime, in another existential crisis, EU finance ministers agreed a 500 billion euro rescue plan on Thursday for European countries hit hard by the current crisis, but sidelined a demand by Italy and France for pooled borrowing. And this exposes again the cracks running through the eurozone. As The Spectator reported, a weakened Angela Merkel faces Germany's crisis of economic responsibility, and France floats the idea of issuing its own corona bond. The EU and its currency face what Emmanuel Macron would probably not want to call its Waterloo. Henry Kissinger's remark, "Who do I call if I want to speak to Europe?" was never seeming more true. Britain is leaving. France and Germany are at odds, with France emerging as the patron of the debt-stricken southern states and Germany, the dominant eurozone economy, wanting all the profit and none of the responsibility. As the eurozone went off a cliff, the only unified European response to the outbreak was to ignore Italy's call for help. In mid-March, Italy, its medical size exhausted, triggered the EU's civil protection mechanism. Olaf Scholz, Germany's finance minister, dismissed pan-EU action as premature. Not one of its euro friends came to Italy's assistance. The German government promised credit guarantees worth 550 billion euros to German companies. And in France, Emmanuel Macron also promised to prop up private firms. But how many other EU states can credibly promise that, let alone afford it? Not Greece, which is already effectively a bankrupt German satellite. Not Italy, with the epidemic rendering effectively it bankrupt all over again, placing it in danger of German annexing its economy. Not Spain or Portugal, which are heading the same way. The alliance of France and Germany is supposed to be the cornerstone of the Union, but when Emmanuel Macron called for issuing a common eurozone corona bond, Angela Merkel refused, though more challenged eurozone nations hope to obtain a cheaper access to funds for recovery. But issuing these bonds could raise complexities. For starters, which European institution would issue them, and how would it pay for them? The eurozone lacks a treasury with a federal budget. It is a monetary union, not a fiscal one. Additionally, establishing corona bonds would require a change to the European Union treaties, such as a no bailout clause, which prevents countries from rescuing each other. The process could take months. The bonds also won't solve the problem of the heavy debt faced by fiscally and structurally weaker nations. The Italian government might pay a lower interest rate on the debt financed by the bonds, but the rest of its debt would remain unsustainable. Those opposing the new bonds prefer the region's crisis fund, the European Stability Mechanism, or the ESM. It already has 410 billion euros, or 3.4% of eurozone gross domestic product, in lending capacity. Funds made available through the ESM could amount to up to 2% of any member country's GDP, a rule that can be adjusted in an emergency. But France's Macron seeks to use this crisis to force the final, perennially deferred stage of European Union, turning the European Central Bank into something along the lines of the Federal Reserve after 1910, firing up the economies of Southern Europe through debt mutualisation and, crucially, printing money as the US is doing. This would allow France a hand in spending Germany's profits from its trade with the southern states, but Germany has painful historical memories about the political effects of debt, admittedly less painful than the rest of Europe's memories, and wants the profits of a consolidated European market, not the debts of the southern states. Merkel has said she would never accept debt mutualisation as long as I live, and the German High Court has helpfully ruled that issuing pan-EU bonds would require a change to the German constitution. This, Merkel's ministers agree, is a problem for Brussels, not Berlin. On April 1st, the Bundesbank, German central bank, declared against mutualising Eurozone debt through a shared Corona bond. Instead, the Bundesbank has kicked the problem back to Brussels, the ECB, and its European Stability Mechanism, the ESM, an emergency loan fund. The ESM is the thumbscrew which keeps the Greeks in debt. The Italians are in a hurry to put out their hands. And Claudio Borgiou, with the LEGA party, rejects the ESM as a political coercion mechanism. The economic and political strands of this problem are inseparable because they are identical. The development of the European superstate is stalled, and the failure to create a bank at its core, like the Federal Reserve or the Bank of England, is both a symptom and a cause. The ECB is weak not by accident but by design. The member states retain just enough power to keep the European Central Bank just weak enough, so there is no single market, only a mass of small nation markets using the same currency. If they are not fortunate enough to be dependent upon Germany as economic partner, France, or patron, the Netherlands, they are unfortunate enough to be caught in Germany's punitive and unpopular debtor's prison. The EU may have been founded on the alliance of France and Germany, but it has grown and functioned through the alliance of Brussels' fantasy political echelon, with the fact of German economic might. Until the Eurozone sovereign debt crisis of 2009, the Napoleonic dreams of the bureaucrats in Brussels remained in rough harmony with the Bismarckian responsibilities of the politicians in Berlin. Brussels wanted to build a single European state, and Berlin wanted to rule the single European market within its customs border. But power carries responsibilities. In 2009, Germany was irresponsible. The sovereign debt crisis was not ended. Its German-imposed punishment by debt schedules drags on, poisoning trust and paralysing economies, feeding nationalists and anti-EU parties across the Eurozone. Southern Europe enters the virus recession after a lost decade of German-imposed debt schedules. Merkel's government was no less irresponsible when the crisis of immigration and borders came in 2015. This time, the German lesson to be taught was not fiscal probity, but humanitarian tolerance. Instead of listening to her neighbours and allies, Merkel grandstanded. She declared that the gates of Europe were open and that all states must accept their fair share of immigrants. Frontline states like Hungary, Italy and Greece understood that they were on their own. The border fences went up. The free movement of EU citizens is now decoupled from the circulation of the EU's currency. Naturally, the EU also calls for debt mutualisation, as that means centralising fiscal authority. This is the development without which the EU cannot become a single state economically. But this is also the fate which no EU public or national parliament, the Germans included, would ever choose by democratic vote. Hence the current absurdity. Germany can afford it, but will neither pay nor assent to an economic policy set by Brussels. The ECB in Brussels can only afford it with Germany's permission, and it lacks political power. All this must seem impossibly distant from Brussels. The leaders of the EU have weightier historical matters on their narrow minds than democratic objections from the Mediterranean margins. For voters across Europe, however, the European Union is again exposed not as a reunion of ancient allies or a rapprochement of recent enemies, but as a fair-weather friendship on Germany's terms. And national leaders like Emmanuel Macron cannot afford to ignore public opinion. The post-2009 rationalisation of nationalist politics was already well advanced, not just in Italy and Greece, but also Spain and France. The virus recession will accelerate that. It has raised fiscal tensions between Berlin and Brussels, and now it's created new tensions between Berlin and Paris. Habitual observers of the slow decline of the EU expected the crisis to come from a run on the euro currency, or the election of a pro-succession government, or a German refusal to underwrite debts and loans. A French threat to issue a French corona bond was unforeseen. It increases the chances of a two-tier eurozone, an expensive German zone and a cheaper French zone that would divide the EU according to language and culture. The debt-conscious northern speakers of Germanic languages with the debt-enamoured southern speakers of Romance languages. But the economic realities that reflects would also become political ones. So after initial relief at the emergency deal struck last week by EU finance ministers, investors will study the small print and conclude the rescue package will have no macroeconomic impact. The main elements of the deal were a credit line from the European Stability Mechanism, credit support from the European Investment Bank, and reinsurance for national unemployment schemes. The dispute about whether a loan from the ESM bailout fund should come with strings attached will be forgotten. Italy does not want one anyway. Giuseppe Conte, Prime Minister, has concluded that his government would not survive the humiliation. In any case, the European Central Bank has done enough to forestall a sovereign liquidity crisis this year. The ECB's pandemic emergency purchase program trumps all else. The only program under discussion that could have an impact, economically speaking, is the post-crisis recovery fund, after EU leaders kicked the ball across to the finance ministers. They have kicked it back. The European Council's agreed text mentions a recovery fund together with a reference to innovative financial instruments. This means different things to different people, but nothing was agreed. The momentum for corona bonds as an instrument to raise finance for the fund may be fading. So how does this play out ahead? Well, perhaps the European Council will instead end up agreeing a small recovery fund from within the EU's 2021-27 budget, with the usual exaggerated claims of how much this amount can be leveraged. The main function of a recovery fund will be to serve as an attention-seeking device for idle European institutions, making no macroeconomic impact whatsoever in a 12 trillion euro economy. So we're left with national fiscal policies and ECB support. Now, if the economic impact of the crisis turns out to be larger than estimated by some forecasters, those who are not factoring in the global network effects of the lockdowns, the lasting impact on sectors such as tourism and transport, and a possible second wave of infections in the winter, then a fall in Eurozone GDP closer to 10% this year is likely, with Germany performing a little better than the average, and Italy and Spain a little worse. And while the German economy may recover moderately in 2021, the South will recover less strongly. The combination of rising debt and falling GDP will raise Italy's debt-to-GDP ratio from the current 135% to somewhere between 160% and 180%. At some point, ratings agencies or investors could start to question Italy's solvency. The issue is not only the total amount of outstanding debt, but also the country's low economic growth rate. This is the third recession in Italy since 2008. Each time, the economy has emerged weaker. So, what if the ratings agencies conclude that Italy cannot service its outstanding debt and attaches sequential credit downgrades? Then overlay the politics. Imagine if this happened in 2021 or 2022, just before Italy's next general election. Mr. Conte and his government are popular now, but the question is, will that continue to be the case once the full depth of the recession becomes apparent? Matteo Salvini, a more marginalised political figure in Italian politics since last year, may bounce back. If he were to win an election in 2022 or 2023, his government might be tempted to default on Italy's debt. And then what? Europe faces a tough but familiar choice. The circumstances of today's pandemic are different than those of the 2012 sovereign debt crisis, but the divisions over a common debt instrument are exactly the same. In the long run, the best way forward will be to build both a fiscal and a political union, but that will be no small undertaking. Until then, the bloc must find a practical fix for existential problems. Failure to support those states in dire need will hurt the European project, already under attack by anti-EU parties across the continent. In many ways, this could be an existential moment for the Eurozone. And to underscore this, the IMF working paper Mapping Contagion in the Euro Area, or EA, banking sector, which was published in 2019, revealed the degree of interconnectedness and systemic risk of the Euro Area banking system. And it's all to do with its bilateral linkages. They looked at 199 consolidated banking groups, of which 90 are from the Euro area, and tracked their bilateral debt, equity, derivative, and off-balance sheet exposures that are larger than 10% of a bank's eligible capital. Overall, the large exposure data set covers an aggregate 90% of Euro area banks' rated risk assets vis-a-vis credit institutions for a total amount of 1.4 trillion euros and 680 billion euros, respectively. Then they developed a contagion mapping model fully calibrated with bank-level data to study the contagion of potential of an external shock via credit and funding risks. They found that tipping points shifting the euro area banking system from a less vulnerable state to a highly vulnerable state are a non-linear function of a combination of network structures and bank-specific characteristics, and they warn that outward spillovers from EA banks to non-EA banks might still be substantially underestimated. So just remember that many of the G-SIBs, the globally systemic banks, are highly exposed to the Eurozone. And it would be an incredible irony if the next phase of the global financial crisis, Mark II, comes not directly from the failure of Chinese banks or indeed the US debt-laden economy, but from a fractured Eurozone. Yet that is where we might be headed. And once again, I would argue that the virus did not create the problem. It simply accelerated an issue which was already going to hit, and hit hard. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.